Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. On this week's episode, we're taking an off-the-beaten-path tour of some of our region's alternative cultures and economies. We'll hear how farmers and chefs are returning to some of our old-fashioned recipes for inspiration, attempting to reshape our region's economy in the process.
So we are, as we have always been, in an interesting moment in Appalachia.
And we'll go back in time to hear what it was like to be LGBT in Roanoke, Virginia, back in the 1970s.
So, you know, if the police was undercover or they were driving around, you couldn't be dressed up in women's clothing and heels and wigs, or you would be arrested.
And we'll meet entrepreneurs experimenting with an old Appalachian crop, hemp.
This is a really good opportunity to engage a lot of people who really need the income and who also have access to land that isn't otherwise really being used.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we're listening back to an encore episode of Inside Appalachia that originally aired back in February. Think back to the last time you went on a road trip, somewhere like maybe New York City, or one of the more popular destinations of many Appalachians, like Myrtle Beach or Gatlinburg, may spring to mind. Most of the time, you just visit a place on the surface. Rarely do you get a chance to really look around and discover all the ways communities have changed over time. That's true, I think, for a lot of road trips. When you visit a place, you don't always get the full picture. But if you know the right people to guide you, you'll discover much more of a community's little-known histories and the stories that you usually can't find in a book. On today's show, with a little help from the right people, we'll share some hidden histories of places in Appalachia, and we'll explore ways people are building on the past to grow economic opportunities for the future. We'll start in a place nicknamed the Magic City. Today in Roanoke, Virginia, you'll find a thriving downtown with a quaint farmer's market and craft breweries. But about 40 years ago, the nightlife in this city of about 100,000 people was a kind of a mecca for LGBT folks across rural Appalachia and home to 6 gay bars. But as we'll hear in this next story, these bars were against the law at the time in Virginia. Producer Cass Adair takes us on a tour through the history of Roanoke's queer scene. We get the inside story here from some of those who lived it.
You see where the stairwell is right there?
Yeah.
The building was right there.
That's Don Muse. He's pointing to what is now this tidy street corner in Roanoke, Virginia.
All of these little spots right here were holes in the walls, like little liquor joints.
Don spent a lot of time in those little liquor joints. So did Peter Thornhill.
You really could have a wonderful, seedy, fun, wonderful, seedy, I say it again, time.
Peter and Don are both African-American gay men. They're both in their 60s. In the 1970s and 80s, you might have found them at any of Roanoke's six gay bars and nightclubs that popped up during the disco era.
If you didn't come here, you died somewhere in the boonies. Let's face it, ladies and gentlemen. These young gay men and women came to Roanoke because they lived in these rural counties. Roanoke was off the chain, okay? It was off the chain.
One of those places that made Roanoke such a hotspot for LGBTQ nightlife, it's still standing, kinda.
We've been through this door many a day, you see? This door is the same door.
It's the same door?
It's the same door. Take a look at this door.
There's no historical marker or anything like that. There's just a tiny red brick building and a sign reading Central Virginia Methodist Mission. But Don and Peter, they don't call it that.
This is the straw.
The Last Straw was once one of Roanoke, Virginia's most notorious gay night spots.
And the best looking hustlers, oh my goodness, they were hot. It was like disco heaven.
When we would go to the club and they would cut on to Ladies and Gentlemen, This Is the First Song for the Night, and it's Sylvester, Do You Wanna Dance? Suicide.
It was.
We killed ourselves on that floor. Then Donna Summer would slow it down.
Yes, it's my last chance for romance.
Then Donna Ross would pick it up again.
Love,
I was just doing a white t-shirt and tight jeans and a baseball cap, and I was damn good looking at it, ladies and gentlemen. Don was a handsome Afro-American gay man, you trust me. I didn't have any problem with picking up any of
the pants were tight.
They were really
tight.
To be clear, these spaces were not total utopias. Roanoke has a deep history of segregation. And some white people, they wouldn't cross the color line, even to go dancing.
There were clubs that you didn't see white gay men and women coming over there because it was still considered, you know, sort of iffy and challenging to be over there by yourself.
But Gainsboro, the African-American neighborhood where Don grew up, it was a really friendly place to be queer.
The first bar was called The Horoscope, and it was owned by a black gentleman named Ron Jones. The liquor was great. You saw as many boys from out in the boonies as you wanted to see that had never seen a gay black man before, so you know that was good. It was just crazy.
So actually, Roanoke's LGBTQ bars were probably less segregated than their straight counterparts. You might even think of these spaces as hinting at this brand new kind of Southern culture, one that was more tolerant, more racially integrated, and probably a lot more fun. There was just this one big problem. All of this was against the law.
There was a big sign in the front door about the ABC laws. You can't serve known homosexuals, drug dealers, da-da-da-da-da, right there at the front door when we walked into a gay bar.
Virginia law at the time stated that a bar's license may be suspended or revoked if the bar has become a meeting place and rendezvous for users of narcotics, drunks, homosexuals, prostitutes, pimps, panderers, gamblers, or habitual law violators. And the reality? Yeah, these bars, they were rendezvous, meeting points, for gay people and for sex workers. Sex work was just part of the scene there. Trans and gender nonconforming people might work the streets for a few hours and then head over to perform at a drag show or get a drink at a bar. And this kind of community, with two kinds of lawbreakers, the quote homosexuals and the quote prostitutes, it attracted the police.
You know, you had to be quick about getting into your trick's car. So, you know, if the police was undercover or they were driving around, they didn't see you, you know, walking. You couldn't be dressed up in women's clothing in heels and wigs, and or you would be arrested.
The policing was really stepping up in the late 70s in Roanoke under the Roanoke Police Department.
Gregory Samantha Rosenthal is a professor at Roanoke College and the director of the Southwest Virginia LGBTQ Oral History Project.
And a notorious sergeant of the Vice Squad there that was well known in the gay press. The gay people we've talked to, they remember how vicious the crackdown on both gay cruising at Elmwood Park and sex work down at the market was.
However, their research also shows that it wasn't just the Vice Squads that pushed queer and trans nightlife out of downtown Roanoke. Another big culprit was a lot more subtle: urban planning.
In 1979, this new plan, the Design 79 plan, went underway. The goal was to basically create what it is today, to attract tenants downtown that would cater to a declining white straight population.
Roanoke Design 79, an adventure in civic planning involving citizens, business, and government in a unique cooperative enterprise, is being partially underwritten by First Federal Savings and Loan, partner in savings with people who are building for their future.
It was touted as extremely democratic. They did some new things that hadn't been done before, such as a televised call-in community input mechanism.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Ted Powers. This is the second in the series of programs, Roanoke Design 79, and today we want you to join in because we need your input into this whole process. I think we've got a phone call.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
The proposal for the cultural center in downtown Roanoke is perhaps the most exciting proposal I have heard tonight.
You say you like the idea of a cultural center downtown.
Right.
Right.
Okay. And we're over here with another phone call.
I would really hate to see the library moved. I just think you'd be wasting a really good atmosphere and a good thing to move the library.
So
the library,
this new democratic urban planning process, it helped generate ideas for things that a lot of people would want in their city, like cultural centers and nice libraries. But not all the comments were so innocuous.
The Design 79 documents we've looked at talk about focus groups with white heterosexual middle-class people, and they said, we're afraid to go downtown because of the type of people who are on the streets down there. They never say trans sex workers, but we get a sense that the city is trying to push this population out of visibility. Gay cruising moves to other parks further out from downtown, and sex work is also pushed out onto more marginal streets where, according to the oral histories we've done, it becomes a lot more dangerous for the sex workers.
And on top of that, Design 79 was not the only disruptor to Roanoke's queer nightlife in the late 1970s and 1980s. Something else was emerging at the same time, something that would further devastate the community. HIV.
It was nothing for you to lose 100, 200, 300 people that you knew.
The impact of HIV/AIDS goes well beyond the individuals and the community who are suffering and caring for each other, but it does impact the way that larger straight society sees LGBT people and increasingly sees them as a threat.
If you had gotten sick in the early AIDS epidemic, and let's say you went to the hospital like Georgetown University, they wouldn't feed you. They left your tray out front. They put yellow tape in front of your door. Your doctor came in on a mask. If you didn't have a friend, gay or lesbian friend, to help you, you were done because they were afraid. They were absolutely terrified.
Roanoke renews its crackdown on sex work in the late 80s, early 90s. We have just arrests in a couple year span.
These days, downtown Roanoke has plenty of places you can go and have a good time. That cultural center, the one that was dreamed up by the citizens and the architects of Design 79, it's right downtown. And I have to admit, it's pretty nice. But now that I know the history of this place, it's hard not to feel like there's something just missing. A whole queer world full of sex workers and drag queens and disco and drinking and dancing. So before I left Roanoke, I made sure to hit up the last remaining gay bar. And you know what? It wasn't that seedy fun that Don and Peter were telling me about, but I still got to dance. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Cass Adair in Roanoke, Virginia.
That story originally aired on the podcast With Good Reason, which is produced through the Virginia Humanities. Like Cass said in that story, you can't learn about Roanoke's LGBT history on any historical plaque. There are a lot of stories like that, beneath the surface. Next, we'll hear about an industry that nearly disappeared about 80 years ago. Used to be, you couldn't spit without hitting a hemp plant in this part of the world, back when it was the foundation of the agricultural economy here. Today, some states are looking to harvest the leafy green for products like CBD oil as a potential way to revive the region's economy. But some states are struggling to seed a new hemp economy amid legal ambiguity and other risks. Reporter Liam Niemeyer visited Winking Sun in Wheeling to get a firsthand look at how the business of hemp is playing out in the northern Ohio Valley town.
Inside Winking Sun Hemp Company in Wheeling, West Virginia, the store owner Doug Flight tries to position himself in front of a camera crew.
Don't buy CBD from a vape or novelty shop.
Good, yeah, we weren't recording.
He's grown and sold hemp for years, but memorizing lines for what he says could be the first hemp TV commercial in the state, that's another issue.
I know, I grow. Is that it?
I know because I grow.
Her.
Isn't that the first part?
He couldn't have done this commercial a couple months ago. Local TV stations turned him down because the federal government still classified hemp with its botanical cousin, marijuana. The 2018 Farm Bill redefined hemp as a legal crop and let states decide how to regulate it. That means farmers can buy and sell hemp and seeds from other states and advertise on TV.
If I was him, I'd make a television commercial too, because for the next 6 months to a year, my prediction is it will continue to be a very, very hot item.
That's Brian Parr, Assistant Dean of Murray State University's School of Agriculture in West Kentucky. Parr says the real money for Ohio Valley farmers is in hemp's cannabidiol, also known as CBD. Proponents claim CBD oil helps with anxiety and pain, Parr says farmers are still figuring out how to harvest CBD oil with less hand labor.
And so we've seen machines shipped in from Europe. We've seen headers from combines that are brought in that were supposed to be designed for hemp harvest that haven't worked.
Parr says investment in hemp is risky. Important measures on crop insurance are still a year away, but that hasn't stopped Ohio Valley farmers. The Kentucky Department of Agriculture approved over 1,000 hemp grower permits for 2019. That's four times more than last year. West Virginia ag officials also approved three times more grower permits. The new farm bill allows states to submit plans for regulating hemp to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Kentucky Agriculture Commissioner Ryan Quarles said his state was the first to file.
For 2019, Kentucky will not be sitting on its hands.
Elsewhere in the Ohio Valley, hemp growers might not get as much help from their states. In West Virginia, the Ag Commissioner says the hemp program is very underfunded. The Commissioner says West Virginia lawmakers need to give more support to its hemp program. And Ohio is one of nine states that have not passed laws to let farmers grow hemp. Ohio Farmers Union President Joe Logan says this lack of hemp infrastructure is frustrating.
Right after we got that farm bill passed, I called down to our Department of Agriculture and said, hey, listen, who's your point person on this? And they said, well, we don't have one.
Logan says he hopes that'll change this year. He says Ohio state lawmakers have not pursued hemp's potential like the rest of the Ohio Valley. And at least one eastern Kentucky farmer sees that potential to revive Appalachia's economy. Pine Mountain Remedies manager Nathan Hall doesn't have a big farm. He's growing hemp on a 2-acre plot in Letcher County, leased from local community members. He wants to make sure money from hemp goes back to struggling communities.
This is a really good opportunity to engage a lot of people who really need the income and who also have access to land that isn't otherwise really being used.
He's hoping hemp can provide a way not only to make money, but to grow stronger communities. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Liam Niemeyer.
The Ohio Valley Resource is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Like hemp farming, the glassmaking industry once employed many Appalachians and may also have a future in the region's economy. Easy access to the river transportation and natural gas provided the foundation of a large glass industry along the Ohio River at the beginning of the 19th century. But industrialization of the glass industry moved a lot of the business overseas. The next inside look we'll take is at a glassmaking factory in Milton, West Virginia, that has weathered a lot of change in its 100-year history. Our associate producer Eric Douglas visited Blinko Glass to find out what their secret is to almost a century of business.
Approaching the slightly rundown, ragtag collection of metal and cinder block buildings that make up Blinko Glass, you might not expect to find much inside. Instead, approximately 20 workers make glass vases and water bottles that will soon be shipped to stores across the country and the world. The roar of natural gas in the glass furnaces is nearly overwhelming. Looking directly into the hottest, brightest part of the furnace, called the glory hole, is an incredible sight.
I do not know what the glory hole is, but it has to be over 2,000 degrees. It's hot. And nobody can see my arm. It's red today. You know, it gets red, but it goes away after a while.
That's Charlie Chafin, one of the glass workers at Blinko Glass. The factory floor was once the exclusive domain of experienced glass workers. Now, Blinko brings the public into the workshop to inspire a new generation of collectors. On a recent weekend, more than 200 people registered weeks in advance to get a chance to blow their own glass water bottles. It was the first time Caitlin Jordan got a behind-the-scenes look at the facility.
I was really interested by the furnaces, oddly enough, to see the actual furnaces. They're just authentic. You know, I didn't know that you actually, blew glass, that you blew into it to expand it.
The art of making glass is nothing new for West Virginians. In fact, the glass industry was once booming across the state, says Dean Six, the vice president and general manager at Blinko Glass.
When the glass industry first came here, it was in what was then Charlestown, West Virginia, which became Wellsburg in Brooke County, way up in the northern panhandle, beyond Wheeling. That's 1813. So that's the first glass factory in the state.
He says the most expensive part of making glass is the fuel needed to produce it.
By the 1890s, and starting a little before that, we discovered natural gas in West Virginia. And that really booms the glass industry because you have a much more affordable, much cleaner, much more portable fuel source.
To make glass, you also need a way to transport products and plenty of raw materials. West Virginia has both, with its many rivers and high-quality silica sand. Workers from Pittsburgh came to work the glass industry in West Virginia.
And Pittsburgh is glass central in the early, certainly the early 19th century, early 1800s. You just start stealing glasswork. Then you just bring down the river and back into the States. So you got to have that skill set, and that's critical. And then we get that seed, that germination in the Northern Panhandle from Wheeling, originally from Pittsburgh, and then just kind of drifts.
Over the years, there have been hundreds of glass manufacturers in the state. But today, there are just a few glass factories left.
There's Marble King in Payton City. Also in Payton City is Wismock. They've been there since 1903, and they make flat glass similar to what we do, but they use a mechanized rolling process. So they're making and shipping all over the world for architects, stained glass windows, crafts.
There's also Davis Glass in Morgantown, which produces glass for lamps. Several individual artisans like Hinkle Glass in Upshur County operate in the state as well. But keeping a glass business afloat these days isn't easy. Blinko Glass went through bankruptcy more than a decade ago. One thing that helped them recover and thrive was doing more outreach events. Today, they have 10 activities a year that target potential glass enthusiasts. And that leads to a one-of-a-kind experience for participants like Caitlin Jordan.
It's a well-known glass company, and I've always been interested in glass blowing. It's just always intrigued me. It was exciting. It was fulfilling, and you know, I feel like I made a one-of-a-kind Caitlin Jordan original. I think, honestly, my favorite memory of the day was standing by the furnace watching Mom do it, go in there and do that first, just with the anticipation that I was about to.
Getting new customers to see the process of glassmaking with their own eyes is the key to the company's survival, says Charlie Chafin, a glass worker who has been with Blinko 23 years.
These are one of the best days you can have. When you got people you don't know, and some people you do know, being here two or three times, it's pretty cool. It's one of the best things. I love it.
Through online sales and community outreach efforts, Blinko is in the best shape they've been in for years. General Manager Dean Six reports they plan to continue making glass well into the future. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Eric Douglas.
In just a bit, we'll hear the hidden backstory behind Dollywood, Dolly Parton's iconic theme park in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, and take a chili bun and slaw dog tour across southern Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
This is Inside Appalachia. Now for the most delicious part of our road trip, a journey through some of Appalachia's most unique food destinations. On today's show, we're exploring some of the lesser-known stories behind places you may visit in Appalachia. And along the way, we've been hearing about some of the ways people are reviving older industries. Some economists argue that our future shouldn't be dominated by one major industry. To thrive, it will likely take many smaller types of businesses that are interconnected. Our next guest agrees. Food writer Ronnie Lundy spent years driving around Appalachia in search of the region's history, recipes, and traditions. Her book, Vittles, recounts her journey, everything from chili buns to a dozen types of local beans. We've had Lundy on Inside Appalachia before, and it was pretty cool to hear her on National Public Radio recently. So we just had to share this delightful conversation between Lundy and Milk Street Radio host Christopher Kimball, talking about some of my favorite foods, and some foods I didn't even realize were Appalachian. But as we'll hear, Lundy not only discovered some mean chili bun recipes, she also found a region that is sprouting networks of small food-based economies.
Ronnie, how are you?
I'm well, Chris. How are you?
I'm good. Let's talk about Appalachia. What is it, an amalgam of a million different kinds of things? If you were to describe it, is there a way to describe it that makes sense, or is just too diverse?
The way to describe it to make sense is to accept that it's complicated and a moving target somewhat. And in that, you can shape parameters around it, but those parameters sometimes shift also. The territory that I looked at ended at West Virginia, and it goes down into the northern edge of South Carolina, the mountains of North Georgia and Alabama, and of course Kentucky and Virginia and Tennessee and North Carolina. And if I left anybody out, please don't hurt me. So even the geographic definition can stretch and come together.
Now you had a van, right? Is that right? You're driving?
I have a van. It's a Chevy Astro.
There you
love
go.
It.
So how many miles? How long? I mean, you set out to do this trip, this pilgrimage. What were you looking for and how long were you doing it?
Honestly, I'm not sure what the mileage is. At one point, I said 4,000 miles. And then I started looking back at my records, and it's really a lot more than that. So it was very literally a journey. You know, the subtitle is An Appalachian Journey with Recipes. And that was important to me because a lot of what is written and has been written about the people and the culture and the foodways of Appalachia, well, a lot of it comes from one person's perspective and their family, but there are other experiences in Appalachia, and I wanted this book to reflect those as well. We hear the mythology of Appalachia is that we are this monoculture. The current iteration of this is that we're all Scotch-Irish and we're all irritated. and we are irritated, but mostly because everybody thinks we're all Scotch-Irish. You know? So there are actually, the last census, there are more people in southern Appalachia who identify as Latino or African-American than there are who identify as being predominantly Scotch-Irish. And part of my point and my interest is that if you look at the foodways, you can start to pick apart this complexity and see all the strands of it and see how it comes together. And it will challenge some of the assumptions that we've made, many of the assumptions that we've made about Appalachia.
A perfect point to talk about food. So you say chili buns carried out from the Dixie Pool Room, wrapped snugly in red grease slicked wax paper, were my favorite. Okay, so now defend that. So these were really good chili buns, or what?
Oh, heck yeah! You know? And let me explain. A chili bun is not a chili dog. That's the first thing to understand. There's no hot dog in it. It is a very fine grained, spicy chili mixture, hamburger mixture that is packed into a hot dog bun with onion and mustard. And the texture is extremely important. It's not like a sloppy Joe. It's not kind of slurping around in there. It's in there being firm. And the best way to think about this is a dish that was, to my knowledge, born in the pool halls. And what you want to think about is if you're in that pool hall and, you know, the other guys running the table and you need something to eat, you don't want something.
You want chili on your hands, right?
Yeah, you don't want to get something hot and that bad. But a little bit of grease won't hurt, you know? Might make your slide a little better.
So let's talk about some more food. This really threw me. The Shack Sweet and Savory Banana Pudding. It had powdered gelatin in the custard. Okay, I can forgive you that. But has red miso paste. Red miso.
And a banana bread.
Now wait a minute. Now that's a Milk Street thing. But you're throwing red miso into a savory banana pudding. What's going on?
Well, we are being, first of all, true to the Appalachian palate. One of my mother's favorite terms about taking a food that went from pretty good to, oh, yeah, buddy, she would say it had a wang to it. And
I
think, join me, Chris, I'm campaigning to make that an official culinary term, a wang to it.
What does wang mean?
Well, I think that the best way to describe it is kind of this accent of sour and salty and maybe a little bit of sweet that just elevates whatever you're eating up to another level. It doesn't dominate. So Ian Bowden, who was the chef who invented this, felt like, I mean, there's nothing wrong with traditional banana pudding, oh my gosh, but he felt like it just needed that wang to it, and he added red miso to it. So that's part one, but here's part two. Do you, Chris, by any chance know where the world's largest producer of organic miso is located and has been located for over 30 years?
I'm going to guess it's not Asia, right? In Appalachia somewhere.
In the Midwest south of Appalachia, Rutherfordton, North Carolina. Huh. So these miso makers are probably about my age, and they were part of the counterculture that came into Appalachia and settled and had an impact on the foodways starting in the late 1960s. And they also represent an interesting botanical, biological fact is that there are regions of Appalachia that share certain characteristics with parts of Japan and parts of China that don't show up in other places.
What's happening to Appalachia now? Is it a million different stories? Is it going back to find its foodways and roots? Obviously, you're involved with that. And it's going to keep some of the past, or is it like most of the rest of America, we just keep moving into the future?
Well, Appalachia, I won't say more than, you know, there are other regions, there are other cultures that value their past. Because of our storytelling history, young Appalachians are very keen to embrace their history. And a couple of things have changed in the economic landscape. There is the absence of coal, which is, of course, being argued about now, but at the time that I wrote the book, was perceived as a done deal. And in the wake of that, communities are looking to establish smaller economies that are interlaced with one another and therefore sustainable. So food becomes a piece of that. You know, food becomes a piece of something that can be produced to be sold elsewhere, but can also feed you and your family. It becomes a gathering place for the people in the community. Food is a way to create a tourism economy, and farming can become a way to continue to stay on the land and continue that tradition. So we are, as we have always been, in an interesting moment in Appalachia. And I just feel incredibly fortunate to get to ride around in my Chevy Astro and write about it. It's pretty fun.
Ronnie, thank you so much. Fascinating book, and it's just nice when someone takes the time and the years and the hours to really do the research and find out what's actually going on. Ronnie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris.
Again, that was food writer Ronnie Lundy speaking with Milk Street Radio show host Christopher Kimball. By the way, if you're looking for more stories about Appalachian foods, head over to our website, wvpublic.org, to check out our Appetite Appalachia series. While you're there, you can also sign up for our new Inside Appalachia newsletter to keep up with all the stories we're producing, projects we're working on, and maybe even hear a bit of the backstory behind some of them. That's at wvpublic.org/InsideAppalachia. For many of us, glancing down at an $800 price tag for a chair would be enough to make us turn and walk away. So what's the value of such a pricey piece of furniture? Well, if the name on the tag says EA Woodworks, it's not an ordinary factory-made chair. And that price tag? Well, it adds up to a lot of time, labor, and passion. Folklife reporter Caitlin Tan went out to take a look at the family-owned furniture business in Lincoln County, West Virginia, to find out how they're carrying the craft of fine woodworking into the 21st century.
Jim Probst's retirement workshop is at the end of a muddy road down a small holler in Lewis County. Soft West African music plays in the background. It smells of fresh ash wood. It's cozy with a wood-heated stove. And at the back of the room, there's a smooth, finished, spiral wooden staircase that leads to a loft. The steps are patterned with a dark walnut wood, all of which Jim built. But as he gets older, he has mostly passed the work down to his son-in-law, Eddie Austin.
Since Jim is retired, he still maintains a shop for work on the occasional piece, but mostly just for fun.
There's a woodworking tradition that seems to have gotten started in Lincoln County, and you know, who knows, he's got two kids and his son says he's going to be a woodworker farmer, so...
Although Jim loves woodworking, the work isn't easy. He puts hours upon hours of labor into each piece of furniture, and it shows. The pieces are exquisite, smooth finished curves, often in a deep cherry wood. But that handcrafting makes the pieces expensive, money that not a lot of people have.
That chair you're sitting in retails for $800.
I'm very honored to be Jim moved to West Virginia from Indiana with his wife during the Back to the Landers movement in the 70s, when many young artsy people moved and bought land here. Jim loves West Virginia. The nature, solitude, and low crime rates, he considers the state his home and says he wouldn't live anywhere else. As a child, he'd learned basic woodworking skills from his father, but the craft is something he taught himself.
I was accustomed to, like, if you know, wanted something, you could build it yourself.
During his 40-year career, Jim became a nationally recognized furniture builder. He's been featured in magazines and two books. His sleek, minimalist style caught the eye of wealthy buyers and several high-end furniture festivals. These things helped put him on the map.
We were in shops in Seattle, and we were in one in Colorado. We were in shop in Chicago. We were in shops in New York, Atlanta. We were out on Martha's Vineyard.
But now, most of the work is done by Eddie Austin.
It started with a girl.
That's Eddie. He's referring to Jim's daughter, Emma.
I was 17, and I had a job as a full-time dishwasher at a local restaurant. And they said, we're closing the restaurant. Here's your last paycheck. We wish you the best. And so I had just started dating Emma, and she came home and told her dad. And he was like, well, why don't you get him to just come into the wood shop?
Eddie started by sweeping floors, but over time he became a top builder for Jim and eventually married his daughter. After almost 20 years of working together, Eddie bought the shop from Jim. He now runs his own business, EA Woodworks, out of the original woodworking space. Much like Jim, Eddie loves West Virginia. He was raised in Lewis County, and as an adult, he's never doubted raising his family anywhere else. He says he can't identify with the phrase, the struggle to stay, a phrase that a lot of media uses to describe the state's declining population of young adults.
A lot of us West Virginians grew up without a running bathroom in our home, and we were able to overcome things like that. And so it really irked me that people would find a struggle to stay. It was never a struggle for me. It was just a time that, like, we needed to dig deeper.
Eddie dug deeper by learning to woodwork. It's been the reason he could stay. And a lot of that is thanks to Jim. The connection between the two shows in their work. Both create pieces that are sturdy while still upscale and elegant. The differences, however, really shine through in their workspaces. Jim's retirement shop is pretty uniform. The focal points are the actual wood structure of the shop, whereas Eddie's shop highlights his extrovert personality. There's a lot of color, and his door is painted purple. Tyler Childers' music is often playing.
Looking over West Virginia, smoking spirits on the roof. She asked, ain't anybody told you that them things are bad for you?
Eddie has also changed what was once Jim's furniture showroom for clients. It's now a laid-back room with a table, chairs, snacks, and many colorful drawings from his kids. There are three other rooms in the shop.
The middle room is actually the room where our lumber comes in. And so we go through anywhere around 10 to 20,000 board feet a year.
That's roughly 50 average-sized trees per year. The next room is where a lot of time is spent. It's where Eddie learned a lot of his woodworking from Jim. Wood pieces are cut, sanded, and glued together here. A lot of the large machinery is in here, like Eddie's dovetail machine. The 1920s model dovetail looks to be almost 1,000 pounds. It makes joints to connect sides of a drawer, and they kind of look like birds. Hence the name Dovetail. The third room is the finishing room, where pieces are painted with a finish and left to dry.
A dark 7-foot-long oak dining table sits in the middle. A lot of Eddie's clients are within a tri-state region, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Ohio. His pieces are no less expensive than Jim's.
It doesn't necessarily matter how much money they make a year or who can afford it as much as who can appreciate it.
Although ultimately a lot of people don't have the money for an $800 chair, Eddie does have an order list for 6 months out, much like Jim did.
You know, you never want to look at what you're making on the hour because it's going to be horrible. You have to love doing this. You just have to love it. And you need to marry well.
Marry well as in have someone in your family that has a reliable job, one that doesn't depend on buyers. But Eddie maintains that the quality and lifetime warranty of his furniture is what keeps customers coming back. Jim also says Eddie is enhancing the business aspect of the shop while still maintaining the history of the craft.
I never really have enjoyed the business part of being in business. I like the creative part. I truly think Eddie's better at the business end of being in business than I ever was.
And much like it was for Jim, it's important to Eddie to pass down the craft. Eddie now teaches woodworking classes at the Coalfield Development School, a work training program based in Wayne County. One of his students has even gone on to work in the industry. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Caitlin Tan in Lewis County, West Virginia.
You can find photos of Jim's and Eddie's work on our website at wvpublic.org.
Back through the years, I go wandering once again.
Dollywood is Dolly Parton's theme park in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. I'm a huge Dolly fan. Huge. My grandmother loved to take us to Pigeon Forge and Gatlinburg. Sometimes we just take off for a weekend simply because she wanted to go. I loved walking through the park and seeing the details of the old buildings and, of course, the rides. It was so much fun that the blisters from my jelly shoes didn't even slow me down. But when I visited as a child, I didn't really think about all the jobs Dolly helped to create in her home county. In a new book called Gone Dollywood, Dolly Parton's Mountain Dream, writer and folklorist Graham Hoppe takes us on a back alley tour of the theme park and talks about what it has meant for her home place in Sevier County, Tennessee. On the surface, Dollywood might seem a little kitschy or mainstream, loaded with over-the-top Appalachian stereotypes. But as Hoppe told WUNC's Frank Stacio in an episode of The State of Things, Dollywood is both a resort attraction and a source of pride for many Appalachians, like myself.
What keeps this park, in your mind, from becoming just a kind of a cliche, a sort of an exploitation of our expectations of country and Appalachian culture?
It's Dolly Parton. It's her presence, her persona, that positivity that she brings to everything, that sense of you know, whether you want to call it realness or authenticity, of sort of genuine caring for her fans and her community. I think if it were almost anybody else who was in charge of this theme park, it would be a theme park, and that's about it.
And that authenticity is really a hallmark of her entire career. Remember, this is a singer, songwriter, actress, pop music star, but has also done a lot of roots music and you know, performed on many other albums that country and western singer or fans may not have heard. And an exceptional businesswoman and one who most people seem to like very, very much.
That's right.
Through it all, right? I've wondered because I've done, you know, stories about Dolly Parton off and on that come through this studio in various forms, and everyone seems to love her. Now, you wrote a book. And so you've even talked to more people. Have you found anybody who's got anything?
Not really. Nothing significant. You know, it would have been, as I set out to write the book, I thought it would be nice to have kind of a counter-narrative. That's something you want if you tell a story. You want to have a little bit of tension. You want to hear all voices. And, you know, it's just, as far as I know, it's just not there. I couldn't find it. And so I'm happy to tell the happy story.
It's a good story. It's just hard to find. She did, and this authenticity, right? She was a sidekick to country music star Porter Wagoner for many years and decided to strike out on her own at a time when, you know, women striking out on their own was not a good idea.
That's right. Well, she was tired of being the girl singer, which is what she was called. That was the role in kind of his review show, in his television show. And she didn't want to be somebody else's girl singer. She wanted to be her girl singer.
Yeah, but again, this is a time, and what year are we talking about here?
We're talking the early 70s.
This is not a time necessarily where striking out on your own is a good idea. There's a little more comfort than it would have been 20 years ago. But being tired of it, because it's a success.
Yeah. Right?
This is a winning place next to Porter Wagoner, and she thinks she can do it. And then her hit song, I Will Always Love You, in many ways was seen as her kind of goodbye, a loving goodbye.
That's right. I mean, she wrote it about leaving Porter's show, and she wrote it about striking out on her own.
Which is to say, and we're going to listen to a little bit of it, that doesn't include any sense of bitterness or rancor. It's about loving, and
That's
it's
right.
about needing to move on. Let's listen.
If I should stay,
Dolly Parton's 1974 performance of her song, I Will Always Love You. I'm talking to Graham Hoppe, author of Gone Dollywood, Dolly Parton's Mountain Dream. So she's striking out on her own, not a guarantee at all that she will ever become Dolly Parton, and she gets a call from Elvis.
That's right. Well, she gets a call from Tom Parker, Elvis's agent, which I think is important in this story. And they wanted to cover that song, which was already fairly, you know, relatively successful, mm-hmm. especially for Dolly Parton at that time. It was probably her biggest song to date, and Elvis heard it and liked it and wanted to cover it, which in 1974 would have catapulted it into the stratosphere. And for someone who identifies themselves as a songwriter, writing a song for Elvis is no small thing. But the sort of sticking point is that Tom Parker wanted half of the rights to the song. And he said, we'll take all half of the publishing and Elvis will cover it and everybody will make a lot of money and everybody will be happy. And she said, no. She said, I wrote this song and these are my words and I'm going to keep the publishing. And if Elvis doesn't like that, he can walk away. And Elvis did. And at the time, she wondered if she had made a bad mistake. Though, as we know, you know, Whitney Houston covered it and it became one of the most successful pieces of music in history.
Yeah, it really is one of the top in terms of its success, its financial success. And of course, she stood to make millions anyway,
yeah.
even as the co-writer of that
right.
song, as you say, when Elvis, at a time in her career where she wasn't unknown, but it would have really launched her career. And this idea of wanting to hang on to what was hers was...
Well, looking back on it, it feels like a very shrewd financial decision, and it ended up being one. But I think even in the moment, just as importantly, it was an assertion of self, yeah. of creative control. And I think that's an important underlying part of her legacy and her persona and what we like about her.
So tell us why a theme park. Why did she decide to embark on that project at all?
Well, she comes from Sevier County, which is a place that even hard to believe, even before Dolly Parton, it was a tourist destination. Gatlinburg is perhaps the most well-known city in Sevier County. So she grew up seeing people come to her home and wanting to get a piece of the mountains, wanting to see this natural beauty. So I think that made sense to her. And she talked about how she wanted to be a Smoky Mountain Walt Disney. She wanted to create this fair, this fun festival atmosphere, which is really, it fits with her personality. It's, you know, it's fun, it's light, it's sort of a nice thing to digest. It's a pleasant way to spend time. And I think that's what she wanted to create.
There. What do you think it does for those stereotypes, for people who go through there, in terms of, I mean, you talk about wanting to take back the narrative. Does it have that effect when you go through there?
I think it does. I think Dolly is incredibly adept at guiding narrative. She understands and is completely aware of the stereotypes. And so she kind of grabs them and pulls them in and then redirects them. So there are hillbilly stereotypes. And so often what we see, if you're looking at Looney Tunes or if you're looking at Snuffy Smith, those stereotypes are pushed in a really sort of negative direction. Dolly takes that imagery and I think pushes it in the positive direction. If, you know, Dolly Parton is the smartest person in the room and also a hillbilly, then maybe a hillbilly is not such a bad
thing. Well, there's a great, you reprised that conversation she had with Barbara Walters, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. Where, you know, Barbara asked her if I had called you a hillbilly when you were little, what would you have done? And Dolly said something to the effect of, you know, I would probably kick you in the shins, but I guess I'm also a hillbilly. I guess you would have been right.
If I should stay, I would only be in your way, so I'll go. But I...
That was writer and folklorist Graham Hoppe speaking with Frank Stacio, the host of The State of Things, which is produced by WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hoppe's new book is called Gone Dollywood, Dolly Parton's Mountain Dream. To listen to more of their conversation about Dolly Parton, head to our website, wvpublic.org. I loved hearing that story behind the song, and I gotta admit, I have even more admiration for Dolly Parton knowing that she stood her ground, even when she was dealing with the Elvis Presley. It's often said that Dolly's not only a great songwriter, she's also a great businesswoman. You might not think of us Appalachians as having great business sense, but as we found on today's show, when you look beneath these shallow perceptions, you discover people with creative, independent ways to survive or make money. Today we heard from a number of entrepreneurs who are reviving some older traditions as a creative way to make a living. I doubt anyone will become as rich as Dolly by making handcrafted furniture or hand-blown glass. Okay, there's probably zero chance that will happen. But these smaller industries could be one of the ways our region is able to adapt in the future. I was born in the 1980s. My generation grew up in the shadow of coal mining's decline. We've been told that we must get out of the region if we want to be successful and live the good life. Some people talk about diversifying our economy, but it's not exactly clear what that will look like. Not one major industry has emerged that could replace coal completely. Maybe to survive, our future will include more smaller shops, farms, and factories making artisanal products or growing the food of the future. Only time will tell. We're going to keep highlighting, exploring, and hopefully discovering Appalachian traditions through the Inside Appalachia Folkways Project. But we need your help. If you know of anyone with a special craft or talent and a big personality, we want to meet them. Email us your ideas of Appalachian arts and culture that you'd like to preserve to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org or send us a tweet at @InAppalachia. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from With Good Reason and the Virginia Humanities, WKMS in Murray, Kentucky, WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, the Ohio Valley Resource, and Milk Street Radio. Music in today's show was provided by Dolly Parton, Tyler Childers, and Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Executive producer is Jesse Wright. Catherine Moore edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us online on Twitter at @InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Visit wvpublic.org to sign up for our new Inside Appalachia newsletter. On our website, you can also subscribe or download all of our stories or look for the Inside Appalachia podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.